Welcome, everybody. Good morning. This morning, I'm going to be talking to you about the five remembrances. And I'll start by telling you why. I've been chanting what's called the five remembrances before my daily zazen now for almost a year. And the teaching in the five remembrances is still very challenging for me, even after a year of kind of storing it in my body by saying it over and over. And I like to think that that's a testimony to the depth of that teaching and not a testimony to me being a slow learner. But it's probably actually a little bit of both. But what I was hoping to do is to chant them together. It's on the front of the program, and I know not everybody has one. So if you have one, please join me. If you don't, either look on with somebody who does, or just listen, kind of take it in to yourself, just hear them. The important thing is just that you kind of have them in the back of your head as we spend this time together. And as we're doing this, I encourage you to pay attention very closely to your felt experience. Just pay close attention to what comes up in you, what moves in you when we chant these or when you hear this, especially if you're new to it, if you haven't heard them before. Pay very close attention to what comes up in you as we do this. So we'll chant these together. This is the five remembrances. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. Lovely. Thank you. So as you heard those words, and as you spoke them, you may have noticed feelings coming up in you. You may have noticed emotions coming up in you. Maybe even tension in your body. Maybe, maybe not. It's just interesting to note. So the five remembrances are also referred to as the five contemplations. And they're part of a sutra from the Nikayas in the Pali Canon. So this is very early basic Buddhist teaching, 2,500 years old. And the sutra from which these come is called Upajatana, or something like that, which means subjects to remember, subjects to contemplate. And this teaching is essentially about the fragility of this life, and it's about our true inheritance. But when I look at it objectively, I see that the five remembrances are really just facts. They're just facts. They have nothing to do with the Buddhist cosmology, nothing to do with any kind of specific Buddhist worldview. They're not really anything abstract. This is something that applies to every human being, regardless of culture or faith tradition. Essentially, once you're born, you get this. You get this. So these are objective truths, essentially, about our collective human condition. And that being so, the Buddha advised, these are the five facts that one should reflect on often, whether one is woman or man, lay or ordained. So he's saying this applies to everybody. Everybody. And I can see why he advised this. In this past year that I mentioned that I've been chanting these before my sitting every morning, I've been really surprised how foreign-sounding they almost are to me, how much I resist their truth. I mean, every day, saying them over and over. And still I'm like, there's some part of me that resists them. I was surprised how consistently I didn't like doing it. And I made myself a promise, I'm just going to do this every morning. figuring sort of that it would become fun or easy or something, but I don't know. Yeah, it's funny how we think, isn't it? But I also made myself do it aloud, instead of just in my head. I didn't just read them to myself. I made myself chant it. And I think somehow chanting a teaching makes it alive for us in a different way. And this teaching seemed especially appropriate to me to be something to chant because it felt like somehow like body-level truth. This is an expression of body. This truth is about change, about suffering, about old age, about death. This is body stuff, very primal stuff. So it kind of made sense to me to say it aloud. So according to the discourse in this scripture, the Buddha says that contemplating these leads to the abandonment of destructive attachments and destructive actions and the cultivation of factors necessary for enlightenment. And for the purposes of this talk, enlightenment really just means recognizing how things really are, seeing reality clearly, less suffering, the less suffering that comes with that vision. And for those of you who are familiar, at least a little, with the life story of the Buddha, you'll recognize the first three of these. The acknowledgement of old age and illness and death. For those of you who know the life story of the Buddha, those are the first of the three sights that he's exposed to that help to change the course of his life. When he finally deeply realizes everybody who is born is subject to illness, old age, and death. Even him, even the people that he loves, it changes the course of his life. His heart is shifted by this. And he is moved to renounce his royal inheritance. He leaves his home. He leaves his life of comfort and privilege and becomes a spiritual seeker to try to figure out, is there an answer to these things? You know, human suffering is a very primal thing, and he was motivated. He was motivated to leave what I think most of us spend our lives looking for. So I think that's interesting, that this was the thing that changed the compass of his heart. He realized he was unprotected, I think. Even with all he had, he realized he was unprotected in a fundamental sense from all this, just like all of us are. So he's shaken up by these things. He's run through by them. I almost have a sense of him almost being knocked back, like when he really gets it. And I think all of us have that moment. I mean, the life story of the Buddha is our story, right? There's some time in our life when we realize, oh, wow, that's me too. You know, mom and dad are going to get older and die. I'm going to get older and die. We all get sick, that this is universal. It breaks him open. It really breaks him open, and it reframes his whole life. And the other thing that it does is that it awakens in him, and it can awaken in us naturally. Great compassion. Great compassion arises when we realize the universality of the human condition, that the suffering that we have isn't ours. It's everybody's. It's everybody's. This is just what we get. That we're connected in that way. A compassion arises naturally. There's a wisdom that comes from that. So one of the central questions of Buddhism, essentially, is in the face of the universality of sickness, old age, and death, what can be done? What can be done? How can we be of service? How can we help? This is fundamental questions of Buddhism. And I think it is often the recognition of the fleeting nature of our lives that brings us to a very deep place. When we really see impermanence, it brings us to a really deep place. And this deep place can be despair. It can be kind of an existential sort of ennui. Even nihilism, maybe. There's an emotional overtone that goes with those things that can feel very, very dark. But it can also lead people to deep spiritual practice. Very deep spiritual practice. And that's a wise response, right? You're wanting to dig underneath the surface and look at what's fundamental. That's a wise response. And I think this is because on some level, I think we know, as Richard Rohr says, we shouldn't get rid of pain before we have learned what it has to teach us. I think some part of us recognizes that avoiding the problem is really just avoiding the problem. It doesn't change it. It doesn't get rid of it. So, by definition, working with this teaching is very brave work. It's very brave work, isn't it? Because for most humans, these are the most fear-inducing facts of our existence. You know, that's underneath all of it. So the Buddhist teaching is strong here. This is strong Dharma. And each of us feels that, I'm sure. We don't much like this teaching at first, but we can all recognize its truth. You know, in Buddhism we say we take refuge in the Dharma. We take refuge in the teaching. So the truth is supposed to give us refuge. And when we're first exposed to teaching like this, we don't feel safe. We feel the opposite of refuge, right? We feel exposed. We feel vulnerable. And scared. And so we usually want to take shelter in our kind of normal operating system, which is that kind of unconscious denial, right? I can stay young. I can stay healthy. I'm not going to die. All the things that I love the most, the people that I love the most, are forever, and I will never have to be without them. And my favorite is my normal response to the fifth one, which is, at least some of my actions are without consequence. I know I can get away with just this one. You know, this little cut corner, this little ethical shortcut. I'll cut this guy off in the freeway, but he'll probably understand. So, I don't know if those beliefs sound familiar to you, but they're certainly familiar to me. And I don't know that we necessarily hear them in our head quite that clearly, but I do think they reflect our operating system most of the time. So we don't really want the remembrances to be true, but we know that they are. So working with this Dharma, working with this teaching of the Buddha is about becoming willing to see what we usually don't. It's about choosing to take off our blinders and seeing clearly the false beliefs that we usually accept. And we think that those lies protect us, and so we cling to them. And I think that's really natural. I think everybody does it. But I think we also know that they don't. That they don't protect us. Nevertheless, letting go of our denial is not easy. Seeing our ignorance is not easy. And I'm using the word ignorance here very consciously. I'm thinking ignorance is very literal in this case, ignoring. We know these things are true. I mean, nobody in this room is deluded that they're not going to get old and sick and die. But we ignore it. It's a choice, in a sense. We just ignore it. So that's why we need reminding, right? And in his discourse, in this sutra, the Buddha explains that there's a rationale for contemplating this stuff. It's a direct antidote to our usual denial, and it's a direct antidote to the suffering that denial causes. The teaching isn't that these five things hurt us. The teaching is that our denial hurts us. That's really the teaching here. And he teaches us that the first three remembrances, sickness, old age, and death, reciting these, spending time with these, chanting them, is to help us shed light on the impermanence of youth and health and just being alive. But essentially recognizing these things are leaving. These things are not forever. Okay? The fourth remembrance is designed to help us work with our grasping, right? Our attachment. Recognizing that the things we hang on to for security, for peace, are leaving too. They are impermanent. They're going through our fingers like sand, right? It's essentially reminding us we don't get to keep those things. And then the fifth one is to help us see the suffering that is manifest when we act, speak, and think in an irresponsible way. That essentially our consequences, our actions have consequences. They come back to us, and they affect everybody. Our consequences have actions. And in the long run, that's what we get. So you're creating your own, you know, what you're heir to. You're creating it. It's up to you. It's up to you. So, why is this important? Why does this teaching matter to us? Essentially, why do we want an antidote to our ignorance, grasping, and irresponsibility? And I think the answer is very simple. It's always about suffering. Ignoring these things causes suffering for us. It causes very real suffering for us. So he's helping. The teaching is helping here. When we contemplate these facts, we are cultivating our spiritual practice in a very deep way. And we're anchoring ourselves in right understanding and right conduct and right effort because we see the reality of how those things help us. And it loosens our fetters a little bit. We feel less bound, I think. I think there's a sense of freedom in this teaching. So I'm going to talk about each of them briefly. The first is, I'm of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. And I notice people's resistance to this a lot. That's easy. This is an easy one to see, right? In fact, so far today, we have either seen, used, or at least seen advertisements for products that are supposed to prevent us from getting old, right? This is just everywhere. This is just everywhere. We know in our culture that youth is associated with all that is good, and old age is associated with all that is slow and resistant to change and all the things that are bad. Now, regardless of the fact that that's not true, that's what our association oftentimes is. And, this is an easy one to see. I mean, if you don't believe me, just go up to anybody in this room later who looks 30 or over and say, "So, how old are you?" And see how they respond. It's almost it's an insult, right? That's rude. It's a rude question. Isn't that funny? That's funny, right? It's a rude question. We don't want to say how old we are. It's when we say how old we are, we feel like we're confessing a crime or something. You know? Yes, I stole the trident from the drugstore when I was 5. And I'm in my 40s. And that is funny because, number one, aging is universal, obviously. We know that. It is universal. Every single, without any exception, every single human being does it. And the even funnier part to me is, once you're born, the only possible alternative to aging is that you're dead. There's only two possibilities, and yet we still don't like the aging. Isn't that funny? Even when the only alternative is being dead. Oh, man, we are hardwired. That is just funny. That is just funny. So my computer has a little calendar programmer, you know, where you enter in dates and that kind of stuff, and then it pops up when that thing is going to happen the next day and reminds you, bing, something's coming up. So we enter in, you know, all the birthdays and all the anniversaries and all the stuff we're supposed to remember. And funnily enough, I had a birthday recently, and as I was writing this talk, bing, the little thing comes up the computer, Martin's birthday is tomorrow. My immediate response was, oh, no. I felt sad and scared. While I'm writing the talk about accepting aging, after working with this teaching for a year, I'm still like, oh, sad and scared. I mean, we really are hardwired. This is deep stuff. So I guess my work with these isn't done yet. So for me, it's been helpful to actually physically say every day, I'm of the nature to grow old. I am of the nature to grow old. I'm of the nature to grow old. This is not unusual. I'm not doing anything wrong. This is what happens. This is the deal. In fact, it reminded me not only that this is what's happening, but that this was good. That this is good. This is good. It means I'm not dead yet. And it's also just the way of things, right? That's what happens. This is the way things are. I don't have to fight with that. I don't have to struggle with that. I can accept it, I can celebrate it, I can even investigate and explore kind of with curiosity. What is this like? What is happening now? What is it like today? These are the changes that come to all of us as we unfold. And we can investigate those, you know, with curiosity and an open heart instead of with fear and resistance. So this is a very deep teaching. The second one, I'm of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape ill health. I think this one's a little harder to see, at least in a sense. I think when most of us become sick, we feel we've done something wrong. We've been careless, not vigilant enough, maybe with diet or something like that. Maybe we try to figure out the person in our life who gave it to us. That's one of my favorites. This is not my fault. Someone gave this to me. So blaming them helps. So obviously taking care of ourselves is hugely important, and you know, being mindful of diet and exercise and mindful living and self-care is wise and of benefit to everybody. It's certainly good to do those things. But I think it's the fact of illness and disease's inevitability that seems to escape us. I think we really oftentimes think that if I just line up everything just right, it'll never happen. So there's something about shoring ourselves up against the inevitable. And we get mad when we get sick. Most of us do. It feels like it's injustice. Something's fundamentally wrong with reality. And that energy is wasted, right? I mean, that's just wasted energy. So what we miss is that illness is a wonderful teaching for us. It really is. Our lives are blessed in that we are given frequent opportunities to slow down, and come back to our felt experience. You know, if you stay home from work and you're on the couch because you're sick, all those other things that you normally complain about are gone. And all you have is just that body and that, maybe that headache or that runny nose or those aches, and that's all. It's very simple. Your life is very simple then. There's actually a lot of joy there. It sounds strange, I know, but I've been surprised how when I'm ill, like, everything gets very simple. You realize, just being warm, I'm warm. Oh, that's so nice, I'm warm. You know, day to day, you don't think about that. Of course I'm warm, but I got to get those things out by Q4. All these wonderful things are happening I'm missing because, you know, I'm elsewhere. But sickness slows us down. We have an opportunity to learn a wonderful lesson about what it is to be alive. So, the third remembrance is, I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. Oh, this is the biggie. The fact of our own mortality influences and certainly informs most about us. And it's the root of all of our fears, I'm told. And in many ways, the unconscious fear or the conscious fear of death drives most of what we do and what we don't do in our lives. And this is subtly present all the time, even when we're asleep. When I'm explaining to people who are new the concept of dukkha, the concept of ill ease or suffering or struggle in Buddhism, it's so fundamental to Buddhism. If they haven't heard of that before and I try to explain it, I say that it's something that's universal to the human experience, and even if right now in their life they have no obvious, gross suffering, there's always that unconscious, subtle undercurrent the whole time, because we know of our own mortality. We're unique that way, right? We're unique on the planet that way. We know what's going to happen. We know that. And there's that subtle undercurrent the whole time. So repeating this to myself, this remembrance to myself every day has been very instructive. And I can tell you, I still, depending on the day, I still can feel a visceral resistance. A visceral resistance to the fact of my own mortality. Which made me wonder, just imagine our freedom if we didn't fear this. It's almost inconceivable, actually, because we're so formed by this. You know, to really not have that fear. I can't even imagine. That would be amazing. That's one of the promises of practice. The fourth one is that all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Now, this is actually my least favorite. This is my personal least favorite. As much as I hate the idea of my own death, I hate the idea of being separated from my loved ones even more. This is my least favorite one. There's a line in Winnie the Pooh that says, "If you live to be 100, I hope to be 100 minus one day, so I never have to live without you." Which is very sweet. Very codependent. It is what it is. I'm not, by the way, dissing Winnie the Pooh. I actually think it's a spiritual classic. I think it's brilliant. But this line sums up this relationship with our attachments very, very nicely, right? I don't, not even for one day do I want to be without this thing. And the funny part again here is that every human relationship, without any exception, ends by separation. Every single one. It could be separation by choice, separation by circumstance, separation by death, but they all end. We know this. We know this. So after we've worked with these four, and we accept what I consider to be pretty stark truths about them, we naturally ask, what do we have then? I mean, what are we left with? What keeps this teaching from being complete despair? What's the good news? What's the point, right? What's the point of anything? Maybe even, Martin, could you possibly have found a more depressing topic for your talk? Was sick kittens and puppies taken, or... It was, by the way, that's next week. The fifth remembrance is just as stark and just as impersonal as the first four, but it represents the one we can do something about. And it's the thing we can actually work with. It's the thing we can actually change. It's the thing we can control, right? And that's our actions. We have control over those things. We can change those things. We can work with those things. The fifth remembrance, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. So this is the good news, as it were. And you know, it is good news. In fact, spending time with all these ends up taking us to a lighter, a more authentic way, I think, of being in the world. I do. I think it opens us up more deeply to our experience. I think it helps compassion arise in us. I think when we recognize the fleeting nature of what we are, of what we grasp, we see the suffering of others who are just like us because they're living in the very same shifting, insecure, impermanent world that we are. Compassion just comes up. You don't even have to try to cultivate it. It's just there. It just comes up. We're living from a very authentic place, a very real place when we're working with this teaching. And this fifth one about our actions is about karma, essentially, right? This is about karma. Karma is just action, cause and effect. For the purposes of this talk, anyway, it is. It isn't reward or punishment meted out by an outside entity or force. It's just as simple as speaking, thinking, acting in a loving way leads to loving results, loving feelings in us. Thinking, speaking, acting in an angry way, a constricted way, a cruel way, leads to suffering in others and us. It's really, really simple stuff. The teaching here is that our actions have an enormous influence on our actual experience. We get to change our reality. We actually have the power to change our experience of being alive, that we actually have that power by working with these things. It's just the benefits of wise action, and that we are the recipients as well as those around us. So when we step back and we look at all five of these as a whole, the five remembrances can also help do one more thing, and that's to give us some perspective, a little bit of perspective on our lives. It can give us a little bit of distance from the individual contents of our experience that we find so challenging. You know, if we're stressed out when we're in a traffic jam, we can ask, how am I going to feel about this situation when I'm sick? How will I feel about this in 30 years, in 50 years? How much is this going to matter in 300 years? All of a sudden you're like, oh, right, yeah. Being late for a meeting is not going to end everything. One of my favorite Calvin and Hobbes strips shows Calvin and Hobbes. They're standing outside, and it's night, and they're looking up at the sky. And Calvin says, if people sat outside and looked at the stars each night, I bet they'd live a lot differently. Hobbes says, how so? Well, when you look into infinity, you realize that there are more important things than what people do all day. Hobbes says, well, we spent our day looking under rocks in the creek. Calvin says, I mean other people. That could have been me saying that so close. But for me, reciting these remembrances is like Calvin gazing into infinity. You know, I can choose to do that every morning before my sitting. You know, put my palms together and chant this. It's like gazing into infinity. And for those moments, I'm able to see a little more clearly what's authentic, what's real, what's important. You know. So, now I want to turn this whole thing on its head just a little bit. This is, like I said, basic Buddhist teaching, kind of standard stuff right out of the Nikayas. And I want to talk a little bit about the Zen perspective on all this stuff, which is a little bit different. The Zen perspective on this stuff includes everything we've talked about, but it also blows it up. Zen has a way of doing that. Aging and illness and death and attachment, these all cause suffering. Yes, they do. They cause suffering. But as Joseph Campbell says, where your pain is, there your life is also. Where your pain is, there your life is also. There your heart is also. Even if it was somehow possible, ask yourself, what joy could actually come from loving something permanent? Love is love because it's someone fragile and impermanent. Loving someone who's fragile and impermanent. There's a short poem that expresses this idea. Seen through thin tears, the world's glittering crystals, beautiful and leaving. Seen through thin tears, the world's glittering crystals, beautiful and leaving. So this whole teaching of impermanence is not grim. The teaching isn't only what's good will end. The teaching is what's good is good because it ends. How could it be otherwise? Where would compassion come from without our experience of suffering? If we never hurt, if we could somehow be born and never hurt, never experience pain, never experience suffering, how could we ever connect to anyone or anything? The answer is we couldn't. We actually couldn't. We couldn't. Impermanence and suffering are themselves the seeds of compassion and connection and intimacy, respect, gentleness, appreciation, all the things that we value. Why do we pick up a flower very gently, just instinctively? You pick it up very gently. Because we can so clearly see that fragility. It's impermanence, we can see that. We don't pick up a rock that way. We love the flower because it's fragile. We find it beautiful because it's leaving. Impermanence is the womb of beauty. And with Zen practice, we begin to see the beauty in everything. We really do, because everything is leaving. And it's shining and it's beautiful. Yeah. In our Bodhisattva vows, we say, Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Dharma gates are teachings, teachings that lead us to freedom. And this Dharma gate today of the Buddha, these five remembrances lead us to vast, unbounded freedom. In our morning liturgy here, we chant the Heart Sutra, I know a lot of you are familiar with. The Heart Sutra expresses, among many other things, the Zen perspective on these remembrances. And in part it says, given emptiness, there is neither old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death. There is no suffering, no cause, no cessation. With wisdom beyond wisdom, there is no hindrance, there is no fear. No hindrance and no fear. In other words, none of these things exist by themselves. Old age exists because of youth. And illness exists because of health. And death exists because of life. Separation exists because of togetherness. So there is no separate thing called life that we can cling to. There is no separate thing called death that we can be scared of. Life and death are empty. They're empty. And we can't separate them. As much as we want to, we can't separate them. And that's the joy. That's the beauty right there. We can't separate life and death any more than we can hand someone just the heads side of a quarter. They get the tail side too, right? So the facts of our existence, these five remembrances are true. And yet from a Zen perspective, they're not strictly true. And yet both of those statements that I just said are simultaneously true. Right? Welcome to Zen Center. We have to live, I think, with the reality of the remembrances. Yes, that these are true. But we also have to remember that reality is much bigger than birth and death. It's infinitely bigger than birth and death. Life and death are the ornaments of who we really are. So, as I mentioned, as Buddhists, we take refuge. We take refuge in the Dharma, or the truth. And during our long winter retreat here, Rohatsu Sesshin, Ted O'Toole, whose Dharma transmission we're celebrating today, in a little while actually, he gave some wonderful talks to all of us. And one of the things he talked about was refuge. And he talked about how some Dharma teachings can make us feel like there's not much to depend on. And when we read these first remembrances, we're struck with that same feeling, like, ah, there's not much to grab onto. There's not much to depend on. And he said, yes, there is nothing to depend on in the conventional sense, but there is everything to depend on in the non-conventional sense. There is no desire, no need. There is just that which is, and that is freedom. That's good news, right? We take refuge in that freedom. We say about Dharma, may all living beings deeply enter the teachings, wisdom like the sea. That's from our morning service. And I think the sea is a wonderful metaphor, especially today with this. Because when we see with what we call small mind, relative truth, we identify with our wave as us, as real. And we get scared for our wave. But when we see with big mind, when we see through the lens of absolute truth, we see the emptiness of our wave. And we find our identity with the sea, with everything. All things are completely interconnected. They can't come or go or be born or die. Life cannot be killed. It can't be. So our fear vanishes. Our fear vanishes. Zen Master Fa Song says, because of true emptiness, there is nothing that can end. So that's the Zen understanding. And I think when we see this, when we even get a taste of us, our fear just kind of dissipates. There is no fear. Old age and illness and death and separation lose their power because we see how limited they are. They're empty too. And Zen brings us right back to this. What Ted talked about, freedom, which is right here, right now. Whole, complete, lacking nothing. Lacking nothing. No past, no future, no fear. Just intimacy with things as it is. So to finish up, I just want to say that these remembrances, I think from any perspective that we look at them, they really represent deep truth for us. And maybe I'm a cockeyed optimist. I probably am. Yeah, I probably am. I believe the truth is always beautiful. I believe the truth is always helpful. And even if I resist it, even if I chafe against it at first, it always reveals itself to be helpful. It always reveals itself to me to be beautiful. And this is one of those things we have to work with. But truth can support us. It heals us. This teaching can heal us. This teaching can inform our lives in a very deep way. We can trust the truth of this. It can help clear our heads a little about the priorities of life. And we can even let them soften our hearts, open our hearts, even if just a little. Even if it hurts, we can choose to soften and open our hearts. Even if it hurts. And that's okay. It's okay if it hurts, right? Pain is where our life is. Pain is where our life is. And that pain can open us, and compassion arises, and we see others suffering as our own. And then we're not scared. We're not scared. We just want to help. And everything's clear. It's all okay. It's all okay. So, thank you very much. I think that's all I want to say. We have maybe a minute or two, if anybody has any questions about this. Yes.
My name is Jeffrey. I'm 70. Thank you so much for helping me be able to say that.
Oh. You're most welcome.
I just want to piggyback on what Jeffrey said. First and foremost, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to know how old you are.
This is that thing they warned me about. 43. My wife is sitting here going, he said that 5 years in a row now. Thank you. Anybody else want to confess their age?
I'm turning 30 this year.
Well done, Hugh.
Hi,
Jan.
I just had my 57th birthday, January 22nd, and it's just a number to me.
Good answer. Good answer. Thank you, Jan.
I'm Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
And I'm 54. I like it. I like being 54. And I want to thank you for your weaving. Mm. The way you wove the hard and the soft and the funny. It just... I feel like I can, I feel maybe I can live more into that myself today.
Thank you. It's wonderful. I encourage everybody. They're really reciting these every day. I mean, it takes, 20 seconds or something, but I tell you, it really moves something in me. I would encourage all of you to work with this stuff. I can't take credit for this stuff, you realize. This is not my stuff. But it's very good. It's very good. Anybody else? Thank you also. Oh.
I like what you said about, you talked about the Zen perspective on remembrances, the lack of inherent substantiality that enables us to see these in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that in reference to number 5, actions after that kind of thing?
Yeah. That's a good question. Given the limited time here, I guess my answer to that one would be, from a Zen perspective, because the fifth one's about karma, and I love the fifth one for that reason. It's so practical. I can control what I can do. I'm going to receive those things. I mean, there's something very, very practical about it. And I really like having something specific to do. But from a Zen perspective, karma gets a little blurry. I mean, everything is both the cause and the effect of everything. I don't think the Zen perspective in any way takes us off the hook. It would be easy for emptiness teachings to do that, poof. You know, there's no me, there's no you, there's no action. It's the emptiness of the three wheels, and nothing matters, baby. I can just, you know, it's not. That's not real Zen. It's not leading us to a. There are no such thing as consequences. Do you know what I mean? That's coming from a small self. That's coming from an ego self. But yeah, from a Zen perspective, yeah, everything is both the cause and effect of everything. That everything is so interpenetrated, there is just this. So yeah, I think my answer is, practically speaking, we work with it like we would with anything. Karma, you know, you work with your thoughts, you work with your speech, you work with your action, it creates seeds of kindness. And also, because of our Zazen, because of our Zen practice, we do have an insight. We can have a glimpse into the emptiness of everything, and that we find freedom there. Does that help? Does that speak to me?
Okay. I think it is an important point to remember that you can't dismiss like the ethical card just because everything is empty.
Yeah.
No matter what I do.
Yeah.
That's an important point. I think of this action in lack of inherency as sort of like, there's something from the garden. I remember thinking about perishable action. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's sort of permanent, but really sort of like infinitely reaching out like to throw a stone in the pond.
Yeah, my understanding of impermanence helps me with that. When I realize that every one of our actions, exactly what you said, it ripples out infinitely. It's kind of like a version of the butterfly effect, sort of. You know, that the thing on the other side of the world doing one little tiny thing. That my kind tone to the checkout person at Cub is going to ripple out and ripple out and ripple out. That. Imperishable is a wonderful. I love his language is always so rich, but I love it because is that permanent? Well, no. But does it die? No. Just like we, do we die? Well, of course. But do we die? Well, of course not. And those are simultaneously true. Yeah, it's a good question. Thank you. Thank you all very much.